Good morning and welcome. You're tuned into 2SER 107.3. It's time for Final Draft. My name's Andrew Popel, and every Saturday morning I get to bring you the latest in books, writing, and literary culture. It's a half hour of books and reading, and I've got some really interesting and fun stuff on today's show. Sam's Best Shot is a memoir of Sam Best and his dad, James Best's adventures traveling through Africa. Now, for any father-son team, traversing the continent and experiencing so many different cultures, moving country to country, would be an adventure and a challenge. But Sam is on the autism spectrum, and the trip was designed to help him develop his skills and increase his communication, particularly in social situations. Sam's Best Shot is the book chronicling those adventures, and today on the show, I'm going to be speaking with Sam and his dad, James, about what their adventures meant for them as a family, but also for Sam. Later on in the show, we're going to be going to the Children's Book Council of Australia Book of the Year Awards and speaking with one of the winners. The Children's Book Council Book of the Year Awards is a great way for children and parents alike to discover amazing new literature. So it's always a really exciting event in the calendar, and I can't wait to be able to announce some of the winners for you today on the show. It's packed. It's always so exciting to bring you new books. And look, I love that we get to sit down and read together in this sort of small radio way. My name's Andrew Popel. You are on Final Draft, and it's all coming up after this very short break.
1917, the Great Strike, marks the centenary of one of Australia's largest industrial conflicts with a six-week-long exhibition at Carriage Works. The multimedia exhibition features large-scale historical images, moving footage, oral history excerpts, and music and poetry alongside commissioned artworks to tell the story of a movement that started in the old Everleigh Railway workshops. Produced by the City of Sydney and Carriage Works, the free exhibition runs until August 27. For more information, visit whatson.sydney and search for Great Strike.
Sponsors of 2SER.
You're tuned in to 2SER 107.3. My name's Andrew Popel, and you are listening to Final Draft. Now, every week, I try to bring you amazing new books from the world of fiction and beyond to share stories that really connect us to each other and help us understand our world. And today is no different. I've got a remarkable memoir called Sam's Best Shot.
It's about my life in Africa.
That's Sam Best. He and his dad, James, travelled through Africa for 6 months, meeting locals and discovering culture, very different to life in Sydney's inner west where they live.
And I kind of got killed because I was in the river where the hippos were. But luckily they didn't charge us, but they weren't after me. Luck, good riddance.
The journey wasn't strictly just an adventure, though. Sam is on the autism spectrum, and his father, Dr. James Best, designed the trip and their experiences to tap into the inherent neuroplasticity of our brains and help Sam develop in a range of areas, including adaptability and social communication.
Sam was approaching adolescence, and my wife and I, who had done early intervention with Sam when he was little, we knew a lot about what the principles behind that intervention was.
That's Dr. James Best, Sam's dad. He and his wife, Sam's mum, Benison O'Reilly, she's the author of the Complete Autism Handbook, were looking for ways to tap into Sam's neuroplasticity and ensure the ongoing therapeutic benefits that they'd been seeing since early intervention continued well into Sam's adulthood.
Some of the newer thinking in autism is to expose the little kids to lots of uncertainty and unpredictability so that they can learn. But also while we're doing that, to give them enough support, or what's called scaffolding, that they can hopefully achieve success a reasonable amount of time. Now, as he was approaching adolescence, we said, well, we know that this works in early in young children. Why shouldn't we be doing it in adolescence? It's another time where, as you mentioned, the neuroplasticity of the brain starts to increase again. And so we thought, well, we'd like to have another go at it. So that's what led to a second go at increasing Sam's neuroplasticity. And we thought, well, where can we go where I'm going to be able to get away from work and actually apply myself properly to exposing him to situations where he's a little bit different, a little bit uncertain. And so Sam had a bit of an obsession with African animals at that time when he was about 14. And so that was the clincher. We thought a trip through Africa. But it had to be a long time. So that's why we chose 6 months.
There's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of good interventions out there for children on the autism spectrum, less so in the teenage years. They really took a different approach with this journey. And, yeah, in doing so, it was really quite unconventional. So I'm Dr. David Trembath. I work at the Menzies Health Institute of Queensland, based at Griffith University. It certainly came out of left field. You know, I received an email from James explaining what he was planning to do, he, Benison and Sam, and asking if I'd be interested in wrapping some research around it. I hadn't received any emails like that before, and I certainly haven't since.
That's Dr. David Trembath. He's a speech pathologist and researcher with a specialty in autism spectrum disorder. And he conducted a study when James contacted him around what clinically observable effects they could see in Sam's communication and other areas as a result of this epic journey that they were embarking on.
Yeah, adolescence, you know, it's an incredibly important time for all kids, whether you're on the spectrum or not. There's an opportunity there to really kind of come out of your shell, to connect with other people, to become more independent and engaged, part of a community. So it is a critical window, you might say, in terms of all children's development. I think for children on the spectrum, the stakes can be higher. You know, we really need to see them shifting into that, you know, early adulthood where they are taking more responsibility for themselves, where they are connecting with a range of people, you know, developing the relationships that will travel with them into early adulthood and beyond. You know, some people will talk about the second infancy from a neurodevelopment point of view. A lot is going on in the brain in those teenage years. We're seeing the patterns of thinking and understanding, the patterns of emotion laid down that will then carry through with kids into their adult lives. So, you know, it is a critical period there.
Throughout
and I
their
think
journey,
in the journey, that's something
James
that,
and Sam James did and many really of the typical
to
tourist things that you'd expect for an African adventure. They visited the big cities and went on safari, saw Victoria Falls. But part of their day-to-day routine was a series of neuroplasticity exercises, as well as regular schoolwork. Because remember, Sam was 14 at the time. And these were designed to continually push Sam just beyond his comfort zone and challenge and engage this neuroplasticity. Sam learnt to play chess and recorded videos of himself talking with strangers that they met along the way, strangers that soon became friends. Here's Sam on some of those experiences.
I say it helped me, it made me improve, and I did some exercise, a bit of exercise.
Yeah, you learnt to box.
Yes.
I understand. Are you still boxing?
Not really nowadays.
Not that much. We should be doing more, shouldn't we?
But I prefer doing exercise myself. Because it's annoying if I do it with my dad.
What's annoying about doing it with dad?
He gets cross sometimes.
I do get cross sometimes.
What do you think makes dad cross? Is it because you're getting better than him or is it something else?
I'm not paying attention because I don't want to do it outside with dad. I prefer doing it inside.
And I think one of the skills that you're developing is the ability to roll with the punches. Mm. You know, we would have situations thrust upon us that you just couldn't predict happening. You know, getting stuck on a border or you know, disease or, you know, getting robbed or whatever it was, getting lost. We seemed to be in the second half of the trip, but I think we were lost more than we were not lost. But so, you know, it was a lot of having just to roll with the punches, realise you're on the wrong minibus, get off and get another one, figure out where you're going to buy food or eating some food that you've never eaten. All of these things that both Sam and I were doing. And Sam, to his credit, and this is talking about you, this is talking about you, that you know, he became a lot more resilient with that stuff. We did have this particular time where we were stuck trying to get into Mozambique for over 2 days.
And it was a fail.
It was a fail.
the machine broke.
And they kept on saying the machine broke, and we didn't know what that meant. And we found out in the end it was actually there was some fighting going on the other side of the border that we didn't know about. And so it was just, well, we never got through. But
pretty mean.
It was bad. But Sam coped with it. I was travelling. We were actually travelling with our niece at the time, who's 21. She just visited us for like a couple of weeks.
She's not 21 now.
Well, she was 21 then. And Sam coped with it better than she or I did. So you know, he was like, oh, well, you know, that's the way it goes.
As Sam and James continued on their travels across Africa, they met people working in disability services, as well as adults who were on the autism spectrum. And these meetings came to challenge them about not only what it means to have ability or disability, but how much our society and our social milieu can come to construct what those ideas of ability and disability actually mean for us. Because you also meet autistic adults who seem to have far more independence and agency.
And I met an autistic man named Michael.
That's right, yes.
And he went, I do it.
Yes.
Was Michael was doing an apprenticeship in carpentry or was woodworking? Was that Michael?
No, that was Eric.
That was Eric. I'm sorry, I've forgotten.
Michael was a man with severe autism. It was nonverbal that we met in Namibia.
Is he in his 20s?
He is. And Sam seemed to have some sort of bond with him going there. But didn't you? You really sort of were intrigued by him and interested, which I was actually quite pleased to see.
I was already used to him.
Yeah, you were good. You took an interest in him, and I think you had a little bit of a bond going there, which was great to see.
And he only speaks German.
Well, he says a few words in German. Yeah,
you did reflect that many of them seem to have more independence and agency, and in fact, the approach that their society or where they lived had seemed to foster that to a greater or lesser extent. And I wondered, to what extent do you think that we construct disability in the expectations, maybe cultural barriers that we put up around people with different disabilities or neurodiverse people?
Well, I think there were some good and bad aspects to that. First of all, what I did sort of reflect on, you know, in the many quiet evenings by ourselves in hotel rooms, et cetera, was that disability is very much culturally contextual. If you are in a village where all the kids only go to school till they're 10 or so and you basically work in the fields and you often have an arranged marriage, that if you're a child with moderate autism, you may be doing pretty similar stuff to all the other kids that are in your environment. Whereas you put that same child into a developed world environment
and
their disability is going to seem much more profound. Mm. So, yes, there's that. And I think that if our expectations are lower, then in terms of what we need to do to get on in life,
and weight,
then there's going to be less disability. But the flip side of that we did see, which was very confronting, was there was a lot of black magic beliefs.
Where people there's no magic there.
Well, this is what some of the people believed there, Sam. They believed that autism and other disabilities were caused by a curse or you know, someone casting a spell, someone doing something bad and getting punished for it. So we did see that. We actually saw that firsthand.
But I'm fine anyway.
Yeah, you were all right. You did well.
Quite early in the travels, you both had a conversation about why you were doing the trip. And Sam, you told your dad that he talked about how it was to help make you normal. And you said that you didn't want to be normal. How did that, James, I want to start with you. How did that make you feel? What did that challenge?
Well, it was very confronting when he said that because we were doing it hard at that point. Early on the trip, there was a lot of stress and we were both being pushed. And Sam was finding it particularly stressful.
And there was a thing that was stressful at the end, however, is the corrupt police officer.
Yes, we did get ripped off a few times, but that's another story. But I said this conversation with Sam, and Sam was really upset this day, and he said, "Look, why are we doing this? Why can't we go home? I want to go home to Sydney." And I said, "Look, we're just trying to help." It probably wasn't the best use of
but we're in
of words.
Sydney right now.
We are back now, but I said, "I want to try and make you normal," which is probably not the best way of putting it. But Sam said, "I don't want to be normal," and I thought, oh, you know, that's really confronting. And from an ethical point of view, you know.
Yeah, I got used to it.
But then I thought, you know, from what my wife, Benison, and I have read, from people who are on the autism spectrum themselves, adults, and what they've written about it, that they really do appreciate it when their deficits in social communication are reduced and they're able to interact with the world more. They really do appreciate it.
Sam, can I ask you about that conversation? When you said that to your dad, what did you think being normal meant? Or what do you think might have been happening?
It meant being just a normal person.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to do some things that I want to do it myself.
It was interesting in that I felt from the beginning that James and Benison weren't thinking about this as sort of an intervention or anything like that. It was about finding a context in which Sam could really thrive and flourish, where those skills could develop.
Dr. David Trembarth again.
My sense is that one of the things that they took away from the journey is the need to, you know, build on that in not thinking about Sam's skills in isolation, you know, all of his many strengths as well as any difficulties he may have, but rather thinking about him in his community and thinking about how they can activate people around him to, you know, really give him every opportunity, you know, and for him to have the opportunity to really positively influence all of their lives in just the same way. So that sense of, you know, the reflections on community and the sense of importance that I think they came back with, it seems like that's something that's going to stay with them. And I think a lot of other people could learn a lot from as well.
Sam and James returned from Africa to family and friends who couldn't help but comment on how different Sam seemed, his ease of communication and the way that he was able to maintain social conversations with people. The family returned for a holiday to Africa and met up with old friends that Sam and James had met on their first trip. And these people also couldn't help but notice the difference in Sam from the first time they'd met him. But where do we go from here? An African journey isn't available to everyone, but Sam's results seem to offer a way forward for many teenagers and adults on the autism spectrum for improving their social communication skills.
We've always been doing that. I mean, since he was born, you know, leading up to Africa, that we knew that that was what we're meant to do. But, you know,
even when I would go to Africa when I was a baby?
No, but, you know, we used to go camping all the time.
Even when I was born?
Didn't we? We used to do heaps of that sort of stuff.
Even when I was born?
Not when you're born. Maybe from the age of three. And so this was merely an extension. It just gave us more opportunity. And since then, of course, too, you know, we say, okay, you...
Well, I wasn't really camping until six.
No, yeah, but the idea of doing lots of different things is what I'm talking about, Sam, which we certainly do with you. And I think that as for any child, you know, that this whole idea of...
And I had to go to Neil's funeral.
Yes, we drove down to... Where was it? Down to around Griffith for... Neil, not Neil's funeral... Neil's 90th birthday, you mean?
No.
Your Uncle Neil. Oh, no, Neil. Oh, right. Sorry, getting my relatives mixed up here.
Neil's funeral.
Yeah, but anyways, yeah. So anyway, we get out and about, and that's always been our objective with Sam. So that continues, but I think that is something that applies to every child, and it's sort of like
Neil
the opposite.
Was a heavy smoker.
Okay, that's enough. It's kind of like the opposite of helicopter parenting, I suppose. Mm. It's really trying to give them as much experience as possible.
You know, in many ways, I don't think this is a story about Africa. It's a story about creating lots of small but well thought through and managed risks in a child's life. And this is something that you don't need to go overseas to do. You don't need to go around Australia to do. It's about, and James talks about this, you know, creating those small risks, giving a child a paper run, letting him cross the street by himself. Just looking in everyday situations where boundaries can be pushed just that little bit at a time and supporting kids to do that.
It's not about Africa. Okay, it's got nothing to do with Africa. It's got to do with an approach to your child that you're trying to maximise their independence and their resilience. And the way you can do that is through exposing them to as much challenge within reason and give them support in that exposure that they need to have a success. So you're really trying to hand over the reins. It certainly doesn't have to be Africa. It doesn't even have to be a trip. It could be done from home, but it's just a way that you... It's more a philosophy, I suppose, that that this is really what we should be aiming to do, is to hand over the reins and give them independence.
You are tuned in to 2SER 107.3, and this is Final Draft. The story you've just been listening to is Sam's Best Shot. I've been speaking with Sam and James Best about their epic journey across Africa. Joining us also from Queensland was Dr. David Trembath, who conducted a study based on reporting from James and Sam around the results of their trip. I want to thank James and Sam and also David for contributing to this story, which really is a big part of why I love doing Final Draft. It shows us the power of stories and the impact that they can have in our lives.
I'm Nick Healy, host of Breakfast here on 2SER. I'm going to be helping Newtown Neighbourhood Centre create the Newtopian Dream. On August 29, I'll be sleeping out in Newtown Square and fundraising to support homelessness services. And the next morning, you can hear stories live from the square throughout breakfast. So support Newtown Neighbourhood Centre. Head to 2SER.com and sponsor the Newtopian Dream. 2SER is a proud supporter of the Newtown Neighbourhood Centre.
You are tuned in to 2SER 107.3. You're listening to Final Draft, and my name's Andrew Popel. Now, the Children's Book Council Awards have recently been announced, very recently in fact, a much-anticipated moment for younger readers and their parents in the search for quality Australian writing. And I'm joined on the line right now from the awards ceremony by Johanna Bell, whose book, Go Home Cheeky Animals, along with illustrator Dion Beasley, has won the early childhood category at the awards. Johanna, congratulations on your win.
Thank you. It's absolutely thrilling.
It's so fresh for you right now, but can you reflect maybe just a little bit for me? What do the Book Council Awards mean for you as a writer?
Oh, look, this is an incredibly thrilling moment for me personally and for my comrade, Dion Beasley, who's an Aboriginal artist from Pennant Creek, because this book has been a very long time in the making. And, look, it's about... as much acknowledgement as you can get in the children's book industry. And so it's just such a thrill to be here, you know, brushing shoulders with some of the most established writers and illustrators in the country.
Now, Go Home Cheeky Animals is the sequel to Too Many Cheeky Dogs. As you can imagine, there's lots of cheekiness and lots of animals in both. The books tell a story that's distinctly set in the Northern Territory, where both you and Dion live. I think are you based in Darwin and Dion's in Tennant Creek? I was wondering how important representing your community and the Northern Territory is for the both of you in your work.
Look, for both of us, it's very important. The stories that we make together are very much come from place. So the first book was set in Mulga Camp, which is one of the communities just south of Tennant Creek, where Dion lives. And then this book has been set in Canteen Creek, which is a couple of hours out from Tennant, and that's Dion's father's country. So for us, it's really important to take what are our worlds, and I suppose showcase them for the rest of Australia. Most places or most stories that I have worked on and the stories that sort of really capture my heart are stories that start with place. So I think it's incredibly important. I think there's a little bit of geographic privileging that goes on in the literary world. So there's lots of stuff that comes out of mostly Sydney and Melbourne, and sometimes as a regional writer or illustrator, you really feel the types of barriers that are in place to kind of breaking through that geographic boundary. And so that's another reason that this book feels, you know, a bit like a triumph for us.
Now, I haven't had a chance to really properly read Go Home Cheeky Animals yet, but I was able to borrow a copy of Too Many Cheeky Dogs actually from my wife, who is a teacher, and I can see from the copy that it's a well-loved book. What do you think that representation you just talked about means for young readers who are reading in, I mean, I'm in Sydney, I'm in the inner west at the moment?
Oh, look, I think the thing about Too Many Cheeky Dogs is that it's got that lovely celebration of local place. So it's set in a remote community and it's the narrator takes the reader around to all the different landmarks in the community, and at each landmark there's different cheeky dogs getting up to cheeky mischief. And I think it's also got the universal hook of the fact that everybody knows at least one very naughty dog. It doesn't matter if you live in, you know, remote community in the Northern Territory or downtown Melbourne, everybody's had that kind of run-in with the growler behind the fence, or the dog that's, you know, run off with one of your shoes and you can't find it for weeks. So it's sort of that balance that I think a lot of creators try to strike, which is creating a world that's inspired by the local but universal enough for everybody to access.
And that creation, I'm going to try and do something that's very hard for radio here and evoke the visuals. Dion's illustrations are just fantastic in the way they evoke these really vibrant communities. They're just fun too, even for me as an adult, to enjoy and search out all the wonderful details. What do you love best about these iconic images?
Oh, look, Dion's got a wicked sense of humour, and it really shows in his illustration. So he loves drama. Like, we hang out quite a lot. And I don't know if your listeners know, but Dion's profoundly deaf and has muscular dystrophy. So his way of communicating with the world is through drawing. And I hang out with him quite a lot in Tennant, and we, you know, go down to feed the dogs at Mulga Camp, where his grandpa used to live. And he just lives for the drama, you know. He'll hold back on the snacks till all the dogs are there and then throw them out. And inevitably, there's a little bit of kind of growling and hackles up. And they're the moments that he kind of really enjoys. And I think I've got a five-year-old, and they're also the moments that she really enjoys, you know, the tension that comes with conflict. And most lovers of great narrative know that, you know, the story is often driven by conflict, internal or external, and I think that that's why Dion's such a great illustrator, is because he's drawn towards those moments of action, and he provides lots of little bits of humour in there to bring them to life.
The voice you can hear is Johanna Bell. She's the author, along with illustrator Dion Beasley, of Go Home, Cheeky Animals. It won the Early Childhood category at the Children's Book Council of Australia Awards. Johanna, thank you again so much. I'm going to let you get back to the reception and the party. Congratulations on your win.
Thank you so much. All the best.
The Children's Book Council Book of the Year Awards were announced this week, and the winners include Book of the Year for Older Readers was won by Claire Zorn for One Would Think the Deep. The Book of the Year for Younger Readers was Tracy Baller's Rock Hopping. Of course, we just talked to Johanna Bell, along with illustrator Dion Beasley. They won Book of the Year Early Childhood for Go Home, Cheeky Animals. The Picture Book of the Year was won by Bob Graham for Home in the Rain. The Eve Pownall Award for Information Books was won by Gina Newton, Amazing Animals of Australia's National Parks. And the Crichton Award for a debut illustrator was won by Van T. Rudd for The Patchwork Bike. We're going to get all of those books up on the socials and on the website if you want to check out more. Congratulations to all the winners of the Children's Book Council of Australia Book of the Year Awards for 2017.
Want to look into the newsrooms of the future? Storyology is the Walkley Foundation's Festival of Journalism and Storytelling. This year, we're bringing you top journalists from Facebook and Google, as well as leading media innovators from 18 cities in 8 countries around the world. Visit walkleys.com and use the offer code STUDENT to get 20% off full Storyology passes. Storyology sponsors 2SER 107.3.
You are tuned in to 2SER 107.3. It's been final draft. It's almost over. I do have to leave you, but The Vulture's Nest is coming up next. Before we go, I want to say a big thanks to everyone who helped me make the show today, to James and to Sam Best. Thanks for coming in and sharing your story with me, to Dr. David Trembath for giving us some insight into Sam's best shot. Also, thanks and congratulations to Johanna Bell. She spoke to me about her win in the Children's Book Council Book of the Year Awards, and also just a huge congratulations to all of the winners. This is Final Draft. You're on 2SER 107.3. I'm going to say bye for now, but I will be back next week with more books. My name's Andrew Popel. I'll see you then.